Hello again, and welcome back to Pirated Radio. Sorry if I sound a bit crap. I've got a cold, if you can't tell. I don't know if you can tell. Maybe I'm just telling you information that you don't need to know. I don't know. In this episode, I speak to Paula Scheer, the actual Paula Scheer. I don't know how I managed to do this. I don't know how I managed to get this interview. But it's the actual Paula Scheer. If you don't know Paula Scheer, just don't listen to the podcast, really. I'm joking. If you don't know Paula Scheer, she's probably the most famous living graphic designer alive, possibly. She's had a career which has spanned a lot longer than I've been alive. And she's still producing sort of award-winning, extremely high-caliber work, even to this day. Her relationship with the Public Theatre is probably one of the sort of the pinnacles of graphic design. She's done some work for some huge clients, for people like Microsoft, Citibank, Shake Shack, CNN. Did she do the CNN logo? Oh my God, she did the CNN logo. Tiffany & Co. Whoa. I'm just Googled it. She's ginormous. She didn't do the Coca-Cola logo. No, she didn't do the Coca-Cola logo. Stupid lying Google. But yeah, she's done a lot. She's done a lot is what I'm trying to say. But I assume if you're listening to this, you know all of this anyway. And yeah, we discuss a few different things, including her body of work, influences on herself, her working with education. We talk a little bit about what she looks for in student portfolios, which is kind of an on-running question now. I do the Hall of Fame thing with her in the middle. What else do we talk about? You'll listen to it anyway. It's literally in this podcast, but yeah, it's good. It's Paula Scheer. Like, listen to it. It's Paula Scheer. But yeah, I think that's pretty much it. The audio might sound different to what it usually does because I usually use a website called Zencaster, which allows you to sort of record in separate audio channels so I can edit my voice and then the guest voice separately. But the link just broke when I sent it her. She tried to join. She couldn't join for some reason. And I was sort of in a bit of a panic, flapping about trying to fix it because I was thinking she was just going to leave. You know, I don't know. Because I'm really quick-witted and I thought on my feet, I sent her a Zoom link. So this is recorded through Zoom and not through Zencaster. So the audio is kind of merged into one. So you might hear some banging in the background. You can hear some horns beeping. She's in New York. It's a loud place. But yeah, I believe that's it. I can't think of anything else. So yeah, I hope you enjoy and have fun. Stay safe. I'm so embarrassed why it's done that. I have no idea why it broke like that. It's not done that before ever. I have no idea whatsoever.
I totally don't. It's not a big deal. This stuff happens all the time. Don't worry about it.
This is very surreal for me. Give me a second, sorry.
Well, I have to tell you, it's usually on my end, and I'm really glad somebody else mentioned it.
So. Okie dokie. So I'm just going to run through the questions. Have you seen the emails that I sent over to you?
I read them. They're good questions.
I have tweaked them a little bit since then. I've taken a couple out and I've changed them around because I've been frantically like reading your books to try and like get different questions and things like that. Nothing's too drastic. I promise you nothing's really out of the blue. Also, I've got a cold today. For some reason, if there is a God, he's decided today is the day that I get a cold. So if I sniffle or something, I am really sorry. Or sneeze or something. I'll try and mute myself so I don't like blow your ears off.
Well, try to contain yourself.
I will. I'm sorry.
I don't want it coming through there.
Hopefully not. So yeah, I'll just begin then if that's okay.
Sure. Okay, absolutely. So, where are you, by the way? Where are you?
I'm in England. I'm in Stoke-on-Trent, which is a bit between Manchester. I know you know Manchester because you did Manchester Design Fest, and Birmingham, which is kind of in the middle. So it's currently 7:13 p.m. here. So it's a little bit short in front. But yeah, I'll just start then. So your career has been heavily associated with this typographic style that comes from things like Dada,
You mentioned Russian constructivism as kind of an influence on yourself and also futurism. And I was Googling online, trying to frantically find where those influences originally came from, and I couldn't find it anywhere. So I'm just trying to connect things together that might not be there, but would I be correct in assuming that those were things that were introduced to yourself at college?
No, actually, my Tawas School of Art did not have a great library. And I started buying books when I was design books when I was designing record covers. And I loved everything that started in, I would say, from 1920 to 1940. Mm-hmm. And I was obsessed with it. And I discovered constructivism and Dada and futurism all at the same time. And they influenced various things I designed. And this was in really in my last years of being a record cover designer, I would say 1980 to 82. I left CBS Records in 82. And I took that sort of work with me. It was very apparent in my early work at Coppell and Cher, the business I had with Terry Coppell before I joined Pentagram. And there's a little book called Great Beginnings. You can probably check it out online. It was the beginnings of famous novels in the style and period in which the novels were written. And of course, we found books from you know, the Russian Revolution, and we found pieces that were from the Dada period, and then we could really use it to our heart's content.
Jumping, I will touch on your time working in record covers, but jumping back to when you were at college, do you have any memories about things that kind of influenced your career going forward from that early stage?
Well, I had an amazing teacher, a Polish illustrator named Stanislaw Zagorski. And I had him in my third year of college, and I wanted to be an illustrator. I took a course called graphic design because there were no courses in illustration. And he gave assignments that were like the assignments I'd get in real life, like design a record cover, design a book jacket, design a poster. And I was very good at creating smart imagery, but my type was always terrible. And I didn't understand typography. And you've got to realize that in the days before the computer, what took up all your time was craft. And I used to have to go to the art supply store and buy press type, which you rub down and you try to keep it straight. Usually I broke it. Usually it was crooked. Usually it cracked. It looked like crap. And I hated the typeface it came in, which was Helvetica. And I would rub these things down on the corners of my record covers. And my teacher, Mr. Zagorski, had a very thick Polish accent, and he would look at the record covers and he'd say, "Type is terrible." And I didn't know how to fix it. I didn't understand it. And he said, "Illustrate with type." And those three words made my whole career.
Mm-hmm. As you mentioned, I'll jump forward a little bit. As you mentioned, you worked after graduation, you worked in record cover design. And you worked at CBS Records, and then you moved to Atlantic Records, and then you Wikipedia has lied to me. But when I think about sort of really influential designers like yourself, Michael Bayreuth, who's obviously a colleague of yourselves, and over the pond over here we've got like Peter Saville, Malcolm Garrett, and Neville Brody, they all have links back to music somehow. Either being
Michael Bayreuth, it wasn't.
He doesn't, but as you've spoken before about how music is a big influence on his work.
Well, Michael's really passionate about music in general. Yeah. I mean, he's a terrific pianist. He loves Stephen Sondheim. He knows everything about every form of music, much more than I did. But he wasn't working in the medium. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how much it's influenced his actual design work. Go ahead. I forgot what I was going to say.
Sorry. The other ones that I was talking about then. Is there some sort of magic spell that you get in terms of working in the music industry that you think people who don't have that opportunity to work within music maybe don't have? Or like, is there something in there that you gained from working there that you get sort of a different insight into visual communication that somebody else might not have, essentially?
Well, it's an interesting question in relationship to Neville, Peter, and Malcolm. And I, when I was in Manchester with Malcolm, I had this conversation with him. Actually, those guys hated my work in the 70s and 80s because they perceived me as a corporate record cover art director. And I was. I worked inside a corporation. I made millions of album covers. Most of them weren't very good. I produced about 150 a year. And I would say maybe 5 or 10 a year were good. Now they turned up whether I want to see them or not. It's amazing how those things live on. Malcolm and Peter and Neville were completely influenced by the recording artists they were working with. And the recording artists really shaped their vision in the way they worked. Because I was a corporate art director and I was not working with a few record, you know, artists. I was working with so many. I really learned how to be political within a corporation. So I would say that my record cover experience had less to do with graphic design in terms of what I took with me, though I certainly learned a lot about graphic design, designing them, but I really understood politics. I really began to understand how to persuade people to do things. And I was very calculating at CBS because I would figure out where the power was and get the most powerful person to approve the graphic. And in most instances, it was the band or the band's management. So I knew how to persuade and to try to get my way with a graphic. And I got very good at it.
Just scrolling down my questions, sorry. Jumping forward from there, you obviously started, and I know I'm glazing over a lot here, but jumping forward from there, you obviously began working at Pentagram a little bit later on, and you still work there to this day. Are you in the offices now, I assume?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of cool.
Yeah, I'm in the conference room, and it's really cold. Snowing here.
Oh, is it? One thing I did want to ask, how is the COVID situation over there? Is everything just free now?
Well, you know, we haven't really had the global discussion about COVID, which is not really a political discussion. COVID is about calculating risk. And once you figure out how to calculate the risk, you probably are fine. If you get a vaccine and you get a booster shot and you avoid places where there are people that you don't know where the hell they've been, you're probably going to be okay. The masks they're discovering don't do all that much, interestingly enough. I just read that this morning in today's Times. But they find that the huge difference in the states, particularly between red and blue states, meaning blue states are Democratic states and red states are Republican states, is that the red states had a much higher incidence of death than the blue states. And that's because the people in the blue states got vaccinated and the red people in the red states didn't. So you find out, well, that's not very good risk calculation. That was politically motivated. That's sort of dumb. But I realize that you can rely on science to a degree, and then you have to pay attention to human behavior. And my team was back at Pentagram since June 12th because we figured out how to behave and nobody got it.
Yeah, jumping back to where I was on the questions, I've completely lost where I was now. So you began working at Pentagram, and obviously in your time working there, you've worked with a lot of really huge clients. And one thing that you've spoken about in the past is when you bring out a redesign for a huge company like a Microsoft, for example, there's inevitably backlash in that people are gonna, you know, get out their pitchforks and come at you with them and things like that. not literally, you get what I mean, So when you're designing the actual redesign, is that something that you discuss with the client in terms of once it actually goes out, there may be some uproar in it?
Oh, of course you do. I mean, you don't design in a vacuum and say here. You spend a lot of time learning about the organization. You spend a lot of time learning about why something was designed the way it was. You spend a lot of time learning who has the right to make a decision about it, and who do you have to please? You interview those people, you find out what they like and don't like, you find out where the corporate bodies are buried, meaning somebody doesn't like somebody else and some other political thing going on that has nothing to do with the identity. I mean, you have to sort of consider all of these sorts of factors when dealing with broad groups of people. And then you begin to design and you present your design and then you represent your design and you represent your design again, and you're building consensus. And then when you build consensus, you're ready to have them accept it and you're ready to make it and it's ready to launch. And then when it launches, this whole outside universe who weren't in any of these meetings chime in and tell you their viewpoint about it with absolutely no education or understanding of it. And that's usually because they're seeing it for the first time. And what you find out is that most people's initial response to something that they were familiar with when they see something new tends to be reactionary. So they get angry at first, and sometimes there's, you know, a diatribe of stuff on Brand New that you have to put up with, or other magazines pick it up, and you might get just trashed online in general. And then it goes away and people get used to it and they don't even remember doing it.
I was listening to your episode of Design in Dialogue, which I believe is from last year. It's on YouTube. And you mentioned how design expectations have risen in your career from sort of the general public. Can you expand on that a little bit?
The computer changed the way people began to see. For example, at the time the computer came in, if you looked at the way most companies express themselves, they might have a little mark that's a logo, and that the little logo might be stuck in the corner of the ad, but the ad was generally copy driven with maybe a small visual. That was sort of the general expectation of advertising, and that's how the world saw things. And they paid attention to these lines that are, you know, generally called taglines, so in relationship to a product, you know, like Nike, just do it. They don't put just do it on the ads now because they don't need to. What happened is that people began to recognize style and typography, which made the messaging less relevant, because the style and the typography and the imagery creates a spirit and a feeling about a place that can be sort of instantly felt and recognized, in some instances more powerful than words could ever be. And that changed because the computer did that. And the computer did that because everybody had to look at typography on the computer. They started to discover what typefaces were. They knew there were bad ones. They began to see things that they recognized that they tried to make themselves on the computer. So what happened is you had a whole world that became more visually literate.
On kind of the back of that, on the idea of kind of almost like democratizing design. I don't know if you know the website Fiverr at all, where it's kind of like people just, it's like, it's kind of a cesspool. I describe it as a cesspool of design where anybody can do anything. What are your thoughts on websites like that?
Oh, they're crap.
Yeah. Is that it? It's just a one punch crap? Is that the
answer? All right, it's a 4-letter answer.
So yeah, this is kind of,
you know, there are, just because something is available for people to use doesn't mean you should look at it.
Mm-hmm. That is very true. There is a lot of crap in the world, and I guess it's sorting the crap from the not crap, which is the best bit. So I have a segment, and this is the only segment. It's kind of the middle bit of the podcast, I guess, which I brought in recently, that I call the Hall of Fame. And it's essentially the idea of it. If I was to ask you to pick one thing from your career, one thing that you've come across in your whole career, which was sort of really seminal to your own body of work, be it sort of, you know, a book, a piece of art, a person, a song, you know, anything. If you could pick one thing that I could go away and research, what do you think that would be? I did put this in the email, and I know it's a difficult question to kind of answer. I can circle back around if it's one that you need to.
I really have to give that some thought. One thing.
It can be anything as well.
Oh, it would probably be American Wood Typography by Rob Roy Kelly.
Mm-hmm. We do have,
I mean, there
that.
Were a couple of books that were influential like that. There were a couple of terrific books on Rudchenko and Elazitsky, which were highly influential. There was a wonderful book on Italian Futurism and Dada. And then there was the Rob Roy Kelly type book that I think really impacted the way I learned and thought about typography.
We have American Wood Type at my university, and I've got it out before and looked at it and been like, this is the book that Paul Asher has talked about. It's really weird, sort of holding it in your hand. But this is a lovely body of, and you can see like the bit that you talk about on Netflix with the R's, where it's the public logo. You can see that, and sort of just holding it is really like, it's like design history in a sense, isn't it? Because I mean, you're up there as design history, so holding something that's kind of, do you get what I'm saying?
Well, here's what's interesting, that wood type was not exclusively American. And that the kind of things that I found in the book are the same things you find in London. If you go to Drury Lane and look at the theaters in the theater district, they're painted with that kind of typography. And I, when I was in London, I saw that and thought, oh, I'm going to paint a building like that. And I did, because it was the New Jersey Performing Arts Center, and it's just covered in typography. I had hired these sign painters who painted the sides of garages to pre-paint my typography on a building. And they took it deadly seriously, and they corrected my letter spacing while they were painting it.
I've just realized that I've missed the whole question out at the beginning. But going back to when you were in education, from what I understand, and feel free to just correct me, but you had a little bit of pushback from your parents and also your lecturers. At the time, there's a story about you were in a design class at one point, and a lecturer came up to you and asked you why you were in his class. And he said, you said you wanted to be an artist. And he said, he looked at your work and he said that cooking was an art form. Would you have any advice for other young designers that may be having pushback themselves from sort of parents and things like that?
Well, when I was young, the only thing I felt that I was good at was art. I hadn't learned what graphic design was yet. It was just that when I was in high school, I was the school artist. I had a teacher named Mr. Tucker, who had an art room with a glass case in the front, and he put a sign on it that said picture of the week. And I had lots of pictures of the week, and that was my whole success. So everything else about me seemed to be an utter failure. And that I had to hang on to that success, or I would have nothing else to hang on. And I think teachers in your life are so important, because their praise can mean so much. And that those are the things that if you don't have the support of your parents, or you don't feel like you fit in, or that life seems difficult, that you can make something and have somebody give it a claim is a fantastic thing. And if you have it even once, hang on to it. It means a lot.
Jumping back forwards now in my questions. You began teaching in 1992. Again, correct me if I'm wrong.
No, I was earlier than that.
Wikipedia is crap, isn't it? Wikipedia.
Oh, don't read it. Don't believe anything on Wikipedia. That's horseshit. I began teaching in 1982 at the School of Visual Arts when I was still at CBS Records. I think it was 81, actually.
That's a good point for me to go on, actually. But the first question I've got a couple of questions on that. First of all, when you're looking at a student's portfolio, be it as in a sort of a learning environment, or if you're looking for an internship, is there something that you're looking for in particular, or is it just sort of looking for good work in general?
Well, good work in general is a good thing. But the things I notice which are important to me in hiring somebody is thinking and craft.
So sort of using your hands and things like that.
Well, making the ability to craft something, you know, to be able to make a good representation, to understand scale and proportions, and is usually the person who has that capability is usually going to do very well. That's the hardest thing to teach, you know, as a design teacher. If the students don't understand scale relationships, they really can't make anything.
So it's sort of, I guess, design fundamentals, in a sense.
Design fundamentals matter. They're at the heart of everything.
Yeah. Jumping on the back of that, and sort of touching on what you mentioned just, so Brian Collins, who I assume you know Brian Collins, obviously, but he recently penned an article for DNAD, which talked about how design educators sometimes can see, designers sometimes can see working in design education as sort of the last hurdle of their career. They will do their whole career and then they will sort of jump off and then go into design education. And he was sort of criticizing this in the article and talking about sort of giving back should be sown into your practice as soon as you're comfortable with it. You know, he talked about this lady in her 20s that taught him when he was in college and how she had a really fundamental impact on his career. And I was curious as to what your thoughts were that on. Should you be teaching from a younger age, or is design education sort of the last stop on your career?
Well, I taught at a young age, so I don't, you know, I mean, I've been teaching for 39 years. Mm-hmm. My students are all over the place. Teaching was fundamentally important to me, because when you teach, you actually learn more than you give, in a way, because you're looking at a student's work and you have to tell them how they can improve it. And to tell them how they can improve it and be fair about it, you have to be looking at it through their eyes, not through your eyes. You have to understand why they were making it that way, what they were trying to do, and where had it gone awry. And that the advantage for the teacher is you get free use of somebody else's eyes. So you get to see something in a different way. It's a very terrific learning experience. I also very often hired my students. I hired my students when I first started my own business, and have for years. And, you know, so many of them have gone on to be really successful and famous. And, you know, that's really wonderful. But I don't think that age has anything to do with giving back. If somebody is a terrific teacher and they're older, what difference does it make? I mean, one of the best teachers at the School of Visual Arts was a woman named Sarah Giovannetti, who was still the most popular teacher in her 90s. So, you know, I think that's like very, I don't think there's any evidence that what he's saying is particularly true. You just had a good experience with a young teacher.
I might have phrased it wrong, sorry. I think the way that he was pointing out was essentially, if you say I had a 20-year career or something like that, say a 20, 30-year career, and then I left industry and then began teaching, everything I'm teaching is essentially already out of date because I'm not practicing still. Whereas if I've sown it into my career throughout, I'm teaching something which is very, it's sort of, they feed into one another, so to speak, I think was the point he was trying to make. I don't think it was an age thing.
I think it's not a reasonable generalization. I mean, it's not, I know, you know, my experience was primarily at the School of Visual Arts, though I quit and started teaching at CCNY to get a more diverse class. Mm-hmm. But I was teaching at SVA for 37 years. As a matter of fact, Bobby Martin and I were both the thesis advisors of a guy. I mean, Brian Collins and I were the thesis advisor of somebody named Bobby Martin, which we shared together. So we actually taught together. People are different. You can't make generalizations about that. I know there were women who were working designers who became faculty at design schools, and some of them found themselves by working with students and pushing students into areas that they never even had the courage to traverse, and they're terrific at it. And that you know, everybody is different. Everybody has their own time machine. Everybody is on a different schedule, and you can't make these kind of blanket pronouncements that you shouldn't do this or you can't be that. I mean, I just think that's very destructive.
So I was listening to your talk that you gave at Adobe Max, I think it was a couple of years ago now, and when you talk about your work, you often use sort of phrases like "we learned that" or "as it turned out," which to me sort of struck me as that you were still sort of learning with each project, so to speak. And do you find that if that is the case, do you find that even now, this later on in your career, you're still continuing to learn things with each project?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, every design is unless you're repeating yourself, every design is a piece of knowledge. And that I find that there are things that are repetitive in my own growth process. And it gets harder as I get older, I confess, but they're still the same things. There'll be a moment where I don't know how to design. And it happens cyclically, maybe every 3 years. There'll be this moment and I realize I don't know how to design. I don't know how to make anything. If I make something, it's something I've made before. If I'm making it and I'm making something I made before, I'm doing it worse than I did it. You know, that there's these moments that happen and I look at them and I can't figure out what's happening. And then I'll have a period of, I think, you know, a more foul level of creativity and some pretty crappy work. And then I'll make a breakthrough. And I'll make a breakthrough and it'll lead me to another phase of work. And generally the breakthrough is an accident because I put myself in a period of free fall where I don't know how to do anything anymore. So I get to learn all over again. And then I get to see it in a different way. And when I see it in a different way, that's when I can push through and really begin to get it to move. And I hope I can continue to do that. You know, I mean, I have been designing for a long time and you know, my vocabulary can become limited and I have to pay attention. And I know it's very dangerous not to pay attention. I've got to look if something is really ugly and I really hate it, that's when I got to pay attention the most.
So if your career is one of sort of a really long sort of almost learning process in human communication, your work with the Public Theatre is probably one of the longest case studies in communication, which has maybe ever existed, really. Could you touch a little bit on sort of the very unique dynamic that you've got with the Public Theatre a little bit?
The Public Theatre is a happy accident for me. I began working with the Public Theatre in 1994. It was the first very big visible project I did at Pentagram. And I was working with George C. Wolfe, a very talented director, and I designed a logo that was based on the things we described in the Rob Roy Kelly book that we talked about before. And it was an identity that was recognizable both by its logo and the style of typography I was using, which was American wood type. And I did a series of posters for the public in those first years I was designing. And I think in the third year, a hit musical emerged and it was called Bring in the Noise, Bring in the Funk. And I designed the graphics for that poster and a series of posters because it was a big Broadway smash hit in this American wood type. And the American wood type suddenly was all over everywhere in New York and everybody was using it. And magazines became redesigned in it. And it was like New York City ate my identity. And I felt really sort of squashed by that kind of both success and then being overrun by this form of imitation. Now, the whole thing with an identity is it's supposed to identify something so that people would recognize it and say, oh, that show is the show from the Public Theater. But it didn't become a show from the Public Theater anymore. It became something that represented New York City. And that's a terrible thing to happen to a client you have who you're actually representing. So after that, I began changing the look of the theater each year and holding onto the logo. And the problem with that was that the theater never got enough publicity because they couldn't afford newspaper ads. They could afford promotions for something they did called Shakespeare in the Park that were in subway posters. But the individual plays were never covered. And people really didn't know what was going on there, or they didn't recognize it when they saw it because I had changed it. After about 7 years, the theater ran into real trouble because they had overspent on an endowment and they didn't have enough money to do almost any promotion. And at that point in time, they told me they didn't need any promotion anymore. They were going to try to do it in-house. And then after a year of it, they came back and they said, well, we'd like you to go back and we'd like you to work for us and we'd like to put you on the board. And that was the way they thought they were paying me, by allowing me to be on the board with all these rich people. And I went to the board meetings and I thought they were boring. And I really wanted to design again. So I went back to designing it and then they wanted to pay me. And I didn't want them to pay me because I thought if they paid me, that everything I would do would be judged under another lens, because for a period of time I was working with them without pay and the work was better because they didn't interfere with it because they weren't paying me. So I didn't want to be paid, but I didn't want to be on the board either. And what happened was that they started redesigning the lobby of the Public Theater, and they put me on the building committee. And I was working with picked the architect I wanted to work on the lobby, who was a man named Jim Polshek, who I'd worked with originally on the lobby. And I found I wasn't going to be allowed to do the environmental graphics because I was on the board and it was a conflict of interest. So I quit the board so I could design the lobby of the public theater for free. So that's been my relationship. Now, what happened as a result of all this sort of political machination that I'm telling you about is it brought to mind something my former partner, Alan Fletcher, told me when I first joined Pentagram. We were at a partners meeting and he was giving a presentation and he started to talk about what businesses who invent something have to do to stay relevant. And he says, anybody who makes anything, anybody who designs anything, anybody who invents anything, really in a normal business spends 25% of their profits in R&D, in research and development. And designers don't. Designers go from project to project, and that they really don't have the time or often the energy to reinvent when they need to. And what I could do, because I had decided to do this very visible program for free, because at this point in time it had become very visible, is that I could reinvent it every year. And it would become really like a lab for me, and the public theater would be the beneficiary of it. And it's really worked. And I don't, you know, every now and then they want to go back to paying me. And I go, no, don't pay me. because it would change the relationship. Mm-hmm. So as part of my exercise as a designer, once a year, I rethink the identity of the public theater for 1 year. It always has the typeface Knockout, but we do different things to Knockouts. Sometimes last year I made one leg skinny and sort of redrew the type that way. And the year before we stenciled it. And this year we're doing something even wackier with it. And I figure that out. And then there's an in-house art department and I teach them how to move the system and they grow it. And it becomes this very recognizable thing for a year and then it goes away. And that, for me, that is my fun. I look forward to it every year. Jonathan Heffler, who redrew Knockout from the original typeface where it came from the Morgan fonts, the things that were in the Rob Roy Kelly book. He, every year when we put it up on our website, he always writes a little thing about looking forward to seeing what I did to his typeface this year, which has always been very sweet. And I love it. And I think every designer should try to find something like that, because if you have to push something, and you don't have to worry about failing or losing a job, it's a wonderful position to be in.
Does the more wacky, eccentric stuff that you do with the theatre, does that inform your more, I guess, business, you know, uptight suit work that you do elsewhere in your career?
Always. I mean, the thing is that work informs work, and that I can't do what I do in the public theatre with everything. But I can do it with some things, not like them, but think that that form of pushing an expectation is really, really, I think, the goal, you know, and that they're all different levels of design that exist. I mean, I remember probably the biggest change I made on something that was in a public space was designing the interior of a parking garage, where we turned it into a type book. With messaging on the wall, and it looked totally radical when you went into it. Now, as a design, there's nothing that unusual about the design. What's unusual about the design is it's in a parking garage, you know, that you change the context of something, or you play with something, or you throw it upside down, do things that are not expected. That's the game.
And in your book, it mentions that it took you 19 years to fully understand the visual language of the public theatre. Why is that?
That's not right. No, it took me 19 years to understand how to do my job. In other words, I was making these, there was an identity and there were posters that were part of the public theater and part of New Yorkers' lives. And they exist in the subways and on the train stations. And New Yorkers see the posters for Shakespeare in the Park every summer. And that it's widely known in the city. But the individual plays at the public theater, as I explained before, really don't get seen unless you've gone to the public theater, because there's no money to promote them. So that you might see an image for the play that we've designed that's inside the theater, but you're not going to see it in the New York Times. So it became, and this is pre-web, web, and even afterwards, because a lot of people weren't looking for information from the public theater on the websites. What I realized is that the thing that was problematic about the public was that the public put on a plethora of shows and other events over the course of the year. And each of them had their own little graphic, and that you could see, you don't control the context in which people see these graphics. Like they might see it on a little small space ad, New York Magazine, or in a little small space newspaper ad, or they might see it as a flyer at some restaurant, or a variety of ways you see these things, and you might not be seeing the same one. So you don't really relate it to the place. The place doesn't build an identity. Identities get built through repetition of seeing something similar over and over again and getting where it came from. When I collectivized the designs for the whole season of the theater by creating this one sort of master brand poster at the beginning of the summer and letting the style of that permeate all these other little small incidental things, flyers, websites, Instagram, it created a very powerful language of the place for a year because it was so lot consistent. It didn't vary from poster to poster. There was always a typographic system, and there might be a picture of one of the actors or actresses in it or some other image, but they were collectivized. So what happened was that people would go to a play and they would photograph the playbill, or they'd take a picture of themselves holding up the artwork because the artwork was everywhere and they had begun to recognize it. So they doubly promoted it for me. And like I said, it took me 19 years to learn how to do my job.
The final question, and I have changed it to the one that I had in the email, because I was watching a talk last night. It was a TEDx talk that you did, like, I think it was like 13 years, well, it might just be TED, not TEDx, like 13 years ago. And you talk about this idea that either design is serious or somber. And you've kind of touched on this idea of sort of more of the fun side of design a couple of times here. And serious design is sort of evokes sort of a childlike and unknowing nature within itself, and somber design is almost the exact opposite of that. It's very informed and educated. And you mentioned that you rarely, at that point, you had rarely gotten any really chances to do any serious design, and a lot of your work was the somber design side. So I wanted to know, since then, and it's like 13 years ago, have you done much more serious design? And also, has your relationship with the idea of serious design and somber design changed at all?
Let me correct your interpretation of it a bit.
Oh, for fuck's sake. Go on, yeah.
Okay. Serious design means that you're taking chances. Mm-hmm. It means that you're pushing an envelope, you're doing something with it. The thing came from an article by a columnist named Russell Baker, who was an American satirist, and he talked about what was serious and solemn in life. And he said, going to church on Sunday is solemn, poker is serious. And what he meant in that is that there are things we do because we conform, and there are things we do because we either get joy or are making discoveries, or that we invest ourselves in different ways to do it. And that all designers have to be solemn, because the problem is the problem, that they have clients and needs that must be fulfilled, and that is a solemn duty. You can't, you have a difficult time taking on the commitment to design for somebody and not pay attention to their needs. And very often that flies in the face of doing some serious work, so that we can find these moments. I think the public theater was one of them for me. There've been a few others. There've been environmental graphics that I found were breakthroughs. There was the new school, which I felt very strongly about, even though it was trashed when it happened. But the fact of the matter is there's moments where something is serious and you take that chance and you take the risk and you can pay the penalty for it or reap the reward. But the act is important. It's serious. Mm-hmm. You follow what I'm saying?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Okay. I think that's pretty much it. Yeah. Okay. Sorry if this has been crap. I feel like I've come along with a load of facts and you've gone, no, that's wrong. And then just corrected me every single time, which is fine, of course.
I did it three times. I didn't do it every single time.
So there's more that's that I've
four.
Got wrong.
That's four.
No, that's completely fine. And again, thank you for letting me give it a chance to talk to yourself. It's honestly a really big pleasure. When I mentioned to people on my course that I was talking to yourself, that was a couple of weeks ago. Every single time I've gone in, people have come up and gone, have you spoken to Paula Shirley? Have you spoken to Paula? Like, it's been every single time. So,
oh dear, really nice. I'm sorry. For you.
Good, wasn't it, that? Hope you enjoyed it. I hope you got something insightful from it. It's really weird to think that Paula Shirley's seen the inside of my house now. It's kind of strange. But that's something I will have to live with now. I'd ask her for some links, but it's Paula Shirley. She's on Netflix. Just go and watch. If you haven't watched Abstract, go and watch Abstract. It's very good. She's got a load of books. The one with the puppet theatre is very good. The newer one, I don't know what year it came out. It's black and it's got a load of lines on the front. Go read that, it's good. If you want to follow me, as ever, I am Pirated Material. And yeah, I shall speak to you, or speak at you, I suppose, next time.